In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Bad data leads to bad information. Bad information leads to bad decisions. It's even worse when bad information is based on manipulated, falsified data. And the only entity that can get away with manipulated, falsified data is our own government. And the other entity and the other company would get sued, or at least fined, by the same government that puts out manipulated, falsified data. Yes, government holds the monopoly on disinformation. Now, you wouldn't know it from listening to the left-stream media, but on Wednesday, the federal government's Bureau of Labor and Statistics admitted that 818,000 jobs they previously claimed had been created never existed at all. They had, overestimated how well the economy was doing and way overestimated the jobs created during the 12 months from April 2023 through March 2024. Think of all the economic decisions that were based on that bad information, and how people would have made different decisions had they known the truth. If you were a manager at a company and believed the jobs numbers that the federal government was telling you, that things are just fine and dandy, and why, just look at all the jobs we created, when clearly things are not fine and dandy, well, you're going to make bad decisions based on that bad information. Bad decisions like buying more raw materials for more goods than you need, hiring people into unsustainable jobs because the underlying economic factors aren't actually there. You've been lied to. If you'd had good information from good, reliable data, you would have made different decisions, like not ordering so much, like keeping more cash on hand, like cutting costs, holding back on hiring new people and instead reward employees who are sticking it out with you to keep them rather than lose them. It's the same thing with all things climate change. We know the climate change data has been manipulated. We know it's been falsified. That's a fact. And yet there they are, pushing climate change, demanding we use green energy, and subsidizing it all with trillions and trillions of dollars. Money spent based on bad data. Bad data that props up bad information, false information pushed on an unsuspecting public. If you start from the bad information that mankind is causing any temperature increases, then all the decisions that follow from that bad information will be the wrong ones. Politicians are wasting trillions and trillions of dollars to fix a problem that doesn't exist. The bad information hawkers convince politicians, who are already by nature all too willing to spend other people's money, that they have to do something. So they're out there slapping up expensive and inefficient windmills and solar panels that are not even green when you take into account their entire manufacturing process and the energy needed to create them. And those politicians' bad decisions cause your utility bills, among other things, to go up, meaning that you are personally spending more money than you need to be, money that you could have spent somewhere else. There's an economic fallacy that goes back to Frederick Bastiat in 1850. It's the broken window fallacy. It's sort of an economic fable. Basically put, a shopkeeper's window gets broken and the villagers all shake their heads and say it's an ill wind that blows nobody good. But then some smart person says how good it all actually is because the shopkeeper will have to replace the window, which means a contractor will have to install a new window, which means a glassmaker will have to make the glass, who will have to get the raw materials, and so on, and all of those people are able to help pay their bills because of that broken window. But, as Bastiat points out, it's a fallacy, because if the window had never been broken, then the shopkeeper could have instead spent the money on things he needed, like new shoes or more goods to sell. He would have spent that money in some way which the broken window prevented. Well, now the government of Oregon has decided to walk down the street and smash everyone's windows. They are pushing a new scam that will force you to spend money on something you don't need to, that you could have spent elsewhere on something that you did need. I'm talking about Oregon's climate protection plan. Now, this is a massive scam, a massive scheme that taxpayers and the voters and the legislature had already rejected, a scheme which Governor Brown decided to force on people anyway. That scheme was thrown out by the Oregon Court of Appeals, but now Tina Kotek is back at it. The main thrust of this plan is to impose a carbon credit scheme, which, again, stems from bad information, that carbon dioxide is a pollutant. It's not. It's a nutrient. If you learn anything in second grade science, it's that plants need CO2 the same way we need oxygen. But now people who will make a lot of money from this scheme need politicians to make bad decisions. And they have been feeding them a steady stream of bad data for decades, falsified data, that, among other things, CO2 is causing the Earth to warm up, and that if we don't do something, the world is going to end. The carbon scheme portion of Oregon's climate protection plan will force industries that emit or create carbon to pay more for it. They effectively have to buy permits to go about their business. Good people, or companies that use less carbon, can sell their credits to the bad companies. Does the so-called polluting go down? No, but some people get to make money on it. A lot of money, including the government, which will set up administrative fees on the money that they are forcing people to spend, and then take a cut, through income taxes, from those who are profiting from the extortion money. Having been forced to pay up those companies who are being extorted, their costs will go up, so they will have to pass those new costs and expenses on to their customers just to stay at the exact same profit margin they have now. What this scheme means is that you are paying to have your windows broken. You'll be spending more because of this scheme, this scam. More for goods, definitely more for utilities, and more for food because, yes, farmers use diesel engines. So their costs are definitely going up, which means your costs are definitely going up. So, like spending for that broken window, you have unnecessary expenses, so you will have less to spend on things that you need, things that matter. As I said, this is a massive scam, a massive scheme, and because it's so big, we're only going to be able to touch on it in this one show. But we needed to bring it to you now because they are accepting public comment on this up through August 30th. We will touch on it again in more depth when we come back after our usual summer break. Remember, when it comes to public comments, you don't need to be a scientist. You don't need to be a skilled orator. Don't worry what someone might think about your comment. What's important is to make sure public officials worry about your public comment. That means you can simply say, "I am opposed to this climate protection plan." Give them some reasons if you like. But the number one most important thing is to not be silent. We'll have some links where you can submit your comments about this plan on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com. Today's show is 14-34. Okay, it is time for a break. Now that my opener has eaten up the entire first segment, we'll start digging into this climate protection plan when we come back with Chuck Weiss. I'd like to welcome Chuck Weiss back to the show. Chuck is a meteorologist, scientist, and fearsome global warming debunker, which makes him the perfect person to talk about and against Oregon's climate protection plan. Chuck, it's great to talk to you again.
Well, glad to be back, Mark.
Yeah, I think this is going to be an interesting discussion. You and I talked a little bit earlier in the week about this, and I know you were none too happy with what you were finding out or not able to find out. But I'd like to highlight a bit more something that I had mentioned in the opener, which is the fact that this climate protection plan, it's a scheme that was effectively said no to three times by the people, by the legislature, and by the courts. The people said no in a ballot initiative. The legislature could not get a bill passed. And so Kate Brown, that George Soros Secretary of State who got promoted up the ladder after Kitzhaber was forced to resign after his scandal, she decided to defy the will of the people and issued an executive order, the original climate protection plan. Then, strike three, the courts threw it out. But now Tina Kotek is out there trying to resurrect this. So just give us some highlights of what your journey of discovery has been.
Well, unfortunately, Mark, I have had zero discovery in trying to get any answers from the DEQ or Nicole Singh, who is head of the climate protection program for the state of Oregon at the DEQ. When I read the act and what's in the tables, it tells roughly how many million metric tons of CO2 reductions they want per year, and then what it would cost the suppliers to comply with those. I was trying to get an idea of the apportionment of who has to, what apportionment of this million metric ton reduction per year, and it's a little over that in some cases, how is it apportioned to all the suppliers like Northwest Natural Gas, ExxonMobil, Chevron, all the big suppliers that they're trying to hit up for this? Because for every metric ton, if you go over your allotment, for every metric ton of CO2 that you emit or allow a end user to emit by selling them either gas or natural gas, whatever the product is, it's $129 per metric ton that you go over your allotted amount. And so my question to her was, okay, what is the allotted amounts? How have you assigned this to each one of these people so that somebody like myself could figure out what you're going, you know, what the gas companies, whether it's Northwest Natural or the gasoline companies, are going to be charging end users per gallon or per therm of energy, depending on, you know, what it is they're selling. And when I called the office, those were my questions for the office, but Nicole was not in, and her assistant told me that I will be able to get those answers because I couldn't find them anywhere on the table in their description of the rulemaking. So she said, if I can't get them for you, Nicole knows what they are. I gave her my email address, and of course she never emailed me back to tell me or reference any of the tables and information I requested. And then, of course, Nicole did not bother to call me back either, and I placed 3 calls to her office to ask for this information, and she doesn't return the calls. I contacted somebody who might be a supervisor to her with the same questions, same thing, going to voicemail and no returning of the calls. So as best I'm able to determine, I can't get any answers as to what this program is going to even cost. If I ran the numbers myself, Mark, and I don't know this to be accurate because, like I said, they're not giving us any information about this. But if I ran, what Northwest Natural Gas is, metric tons of CO2 that were emitted like in the last year were, and applied this $129 per metric ton to that whole figure, it would increase your gas bill substantially. It would go up by $64 in the wintertime with an average of 90 therms of use and almost $20 for 27 therms in the summer. Now, those figures you can't rely on because, like I said, with no answers, you don't get any absolutes in anything. But all I can tell you is that $129 per metric ton and then a 4.5% kickback that the DEQ gets from giving this money to the people who are going to do the community climate investment programs, this is an extremely expensive thing. And Northwest Natural Gas has already warned their customers, and DEQ is not happy with them. They're saying, you're misrepresenting this, but right. I don't think the Northwest Gas is at all. They've already warned their customers, hey, if this thing kicks in, you may be looking at a 14% increase at the very start of the program to your natural gas bill. Mm-hmm. And that's significant for a lot of people. And so the only thing this thing is going to do, and the sad thing about it all, is when you take a look at how everything works in this program and how it's supposed to reduce atmospheric CO2, in my opinion, this thing is a big fraud. It isn't going to accomplish one single thing with respect to actually reducing the free air atmospheric CO2 concentration or any aspect of the weather or climate. It's not going to have any effect whatsoever. So what's the point in this, except that it's a big money-making scheme for special interest groups and our own government? That's about the bottom line.
Well, there's a finite number of windmills and solar panels that they're going to be able to slap up, so maybe this is just the next phase of the climate change scam, which is they're just going to tax people for breathing and for, you know, industries that are emitting CO2 as just part of their daily business. It is frustrating, I'm sure, that you're not able to get any of these answers because this is the middle of the public comment period. And how is the public supposed to comment on things that they're not giving good answers to or even bothering to respond to questions? You had mentioned that this is $129 per metric ton. Give us an idea of what that looks like. I mean, how hard is that to emit a metric ton of CO2? I mean, is that something like the average car would emit during a year?
Well, to suppliers, it's not hard to get to a metric ton at all. Because in gasoline, that's the real big offender if you want to talk about how much gasoline gets converted to CO2, because for every molecule of octane, you get 8 molecules of CO2 or 8 moles of CO2. And so it's 8 times for every molecule of octane burn that you're going to get a CO2 production. So those numbers would skyrocket fairly fast, whereas with methane or natural gas, it's 1-to-1. For every mole of methane, you get 1 mole of CO2. But you're still talking about, as a supplier, delivering several million metric or several million cubic feet of a substance like natural gas and several million gallons of gas sold as gasoline. So when you do those calculations and run the numbers out, they become very, very large. And we find that, like with natural gas, but this is another thing. If I look at their tables, I can't make any sense out of their tables either because they don't show you how they do their calculations. But if I just run them myself, Northwest Natural in this last year came close to emitting like 6,000, right around 6,400 metric tons of CO2, but they've got it a factor of three times that the way they do their calculations, which don't make any sense to me. Mm. And when it comes to gasoline, it's much larger than that. You get, you know, way up there in the metric tonnage as to how much CO2 is produced by burning octane. But it's irrelevant to the major problem, because the bottom line is, when you do all those calculations and you say, okay, here's the emissions that are going into the atmosphere, and Oregon claims that it's putting that the emitters, humans, and all the users of these fossil fuels are putting roughly 60 million metric tons of CO2 into the atmosphere per year, and they want to cut that way down. I don't know if that's the actual number, though, because, like I said, I can't figure out how these people are calculating it.
But it's because they can't figure it out either, and that might be why they're trying to obscure those numbers. Okay, it is time for break. If Oregon gets its way, your bills are about to go up thanks to their climate protection plan. We'll continue that discussion with Chuck Weiss after this. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today about Oregon's latest scam, their climate protection plan. This is going to add a lot of money to your monthly bills here, as if you aren't already paying enough. But Oregon has dreamed up a new scheme to do that, to punish people for basically living. So, Chuck, you were just starting another thought there about the emissions. So why don't you go ahead and continue that?
Okay, yeah. So in Oregon, the DEQ claims that the total emissions of carbon dioxide in metric tons per year in Oregon is 60 million. So according to the DEQ, we emit 60 million metric tons of CO2. One of the reasons why this whole program is irrelevant and stupid and doesn't make any sense and won't accomplish anything is that even if you eliminated every single one of those metric tons and brought it down to zero, comparing that to what goes on globally, there's 37 billion metric tons of CO2 emitted globally, so Oregon's share is 0.16%. I mean, you're not even going to make a dent in this if you eliminated all of it, and it's impossible to do. And even if you eliminated everything like this globally, we get into this discussion about, well, what portion of human emissions of CO2 are responsible for the total into the atmosphere? And all the research that's coming out on that now shows it's anything but what these people claimed that it was at the start of their whole argument, which was saying everything above the pre-industrial amount of 280 parts per million was caused by humans. That's not true. And the research is showing that's coming out now that absolutely is not true. And if we get into that and start discussing that, we're finding a lot of evidence that that can't be true, and there's a lot of common sense behind the reasoning of that. And one of them is that we know that emissions of CO2 by nature are temperature dependent. So if you have a climate that's warming, nature is going to emit far more CO2 than humans do, and vice versa. If it gets colder, the nature is going to take carbon out of the atmosphere a lot faster than human CO2 or human emissions of CO2 can put into it. So in the end, it's not the driver of the total that's in the atmosphere. Nature drives that. And one of the things that convinced me that this is true is that way back in the era when atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons was going on between us and the Soviet Union, a chemist had devised a scheme to determine how much CO2 that's going into the atmosphere was related to human emissions of it. And one of the ways that they can do this is there's an isotope of carbon called carbon-14. It's radioactive. It has a radioactive half-life of almost 6,000 years. And so because that's such a long time period, it's stable to use as a comparison to anything else in shorter time frames like centuries or things like that. And so they took a standard amount of this carbon-14 that they found with 280 parts per million of CO2, and they use that standard to determine, okay, how much of the carbon going into the atmosphere as the CO2 levels go up is caused by humans. And so what they determined from that was when the nuclear weapons testing went off and people started, you know, us and the Soviet Union, old Soviet Union, started detonating atomic weapons, and they were all thermonuclear, so a lot of carbon-14 was made by those tests. The amount of C-14 rose dramatically. And then when everybody decided we're not going to do atmospheric tests anymore, because the last one they did was from the Soviet Union, and it was a thermonuclear test called Tsar Bomba. It was a Russian name for the nuclear test, and they blew this 52 megaton thermonuclear weapon off over the Arctic Ocean. And the shock wave was so big, that was 52 megaton weapon is 52 million tons of TNT equivalent. That's how big the explosion was from the detonation. And the shock wave was so severe, it went all the way around the world, and meteorologists in Chicago could measure it on a microbarograph trace that far away. And it outraged the environmentalist, who said, enough's enough, no more of this. And the United States and the Soviet Union came to an agreement back then that we're not going to do any more of this atmospheric testing. And when they stopped it, then we were able to watch the carbon-14 isotope go down in the atmosphere and determine its residence time, or how long these molecules stay in the atmosphere. And it comes out to a residence time of 10 years. Well, when we watched that go down, it should have returned if humans were responsible for 100% of the increase since the start of that program before the atomic testing started, and we used the carbon-14 isotope tracer, we would have found that would go back down not only to its reference level of zero when the program started, but it would drop to some level below that, because you're diluting the carbon-14s, which stay stable, with the carbon-12s. And the carbon-12s are called cold carbon, which means they don't have radioactive C-14 in them. So if you dilute the C-14 with 12s, that ratio keeps going down and it drops below zero. So what's happened since then? What we have found is the amount of carbon-14 has actually not gone down to its original level, but it stayed at 200 per mil above that. And that's where it's leveling off now. And what that tells you is that nature is recycling those carbon-14s. It's not absorbing all of them as CO2 increases in the total atmosphere. And so as humans added more CO2 compared to nature, you can't tell the difference between the carbon-12s. But if you insisted that 100% of the increase was owing to human emissions, that ratio would have to be several hundred below its reference level, and it's not. It's actually 200 above. So if you're recycling carbon-14s, it means carbon is being put into the atmosphere naturally by nature, and that's what's driving the total increase. It has nothing to do with human emissions of CO2. There is a component of that, and there's a small amount that's due to human emissions, but it's in the order of like 20 parts per million out of the 130 parts per million increase. It's very small, and that throws everything these people do way off in being able to accomplish any of their goals. Because if you stop all emissions of human CO2 from burning fossil fuels, we're at 426 parts per million now. You'd be lucky if you got that below 388, according to the model that Ed Berry runs, and that's a very good one, and accurately portrays what's happening with carbon in the atmosphere. So the whole thing, I hope I made sense to you, the whole thing is just a fraud. Humans don't control the total in the atmosphere, and they certainly, CO2 doesn't control the climate. We can get into the reasons for that, too, if you would like.
Yes, why don't we go ahead and do that. Everyone stay with us. We'll pick up on that note with Chuck Weiss after this. You know, there's a meme out there I've seen lately that I've come to like. It says people who have the least understanding are the easiest to control. And given that, it's no wonder Oregon schools aren't educating kids, especially mathematics and science. And we're talking about Oregon's latest scheme, the Climate Protection Plan. We're talking about that with Chuck Weiss. And a large part of that depends on the public believing CO2 is the enemy. And Chuck, I think it's fair to say, just based on what you said there in that last segment, that CO2 is definitely not the enemy here.
It's not the enemy. And the more important thing is, humans are not controlling the direction and magnitude of the increases or decreases in the atmosphere. Our contribution is very small, maybe 20 parts per million out of the 130 increase since the start of the Industrial Revolution. But they're saying it's 100% caused by humans, and so they take that number and then they plug it into their failed climate models and come up with all this warming. That's another long story you could get into as to why that doesn't work. And all the latest research has shown And I wrote an article about that was published on Edbury as well, that it's not CO2 that's caused the warming since the start of the satellite record. It's the change in Earth albedo, or the amount of sunlight that gets through and reaches the surface. We've had a very slight change in the total cloud cover. There was a new paper that just came out about that, in addition to the article I wrote last year.
So that shows
this small change in the amount of sunlight reaching the ground is what's responsible for the warming. CO2 is along for the ride. It doesn't have the ability to do what these people say that it does, and they have to rely on these false water vapor feedbacks in order to get the warming that they desire to scare people with. And there is no positive feedback to it. It's not the way the atmospheric system works.
Well, going on to that last break there, you said that humans don't control the CO2 in the atmosphere, and even if we did, CO2 doesn't control the climate. So how is it that so much of climate change is blamed on CO2? Is it just simply people not understanding the math, and therefore anybody, you know, like, for example, they go to a politician that says, oh my gosh, humans are causing all this CO2, and you've got to do something about it. Is that all it is? Is the politician doesn't have the knowledge to say, no, that's not happening?
Well, I'm not sure how both of these parties ended up, you know, the politician and academia ended up conspiring with each other, but there's something terribly wrong, because I know for a fact that there are many good professors at the universities trained in earth sciences and physics and math that would look at this problem and they know right away it's faulty. But they're not allowed to speak out against it. Mm. If they do, they're reprimanded, punished, and even fired, and just handled very severely for speaking the truth about this. So the universities are keeping all the professors capable of looking at this problem very tight-lipped. And like I said, if you don't publish a paper that supports this paradigm that CO2 is causing climate change and we need to do something about it, you either don't get published, or if you try to publish against it, they will terminate you. And we saw an example of that, actually a couple examples of that, at Oregon State University with one of the best climatologists we'd had working in the state, George Taylor, who was just ostracized for not buying into all of this business about CO2. Then we had a chemistry professor, organic chemistry professor by the name of Nicholas Trapella. He was fired summarily with no reason given, but we know what the reason was, because he was teaching his students that there's not a lot of truth to this idea that CO2 causes the climate to warm. And he had a good background in spectroscopy, so he was able to discuss this with his students, and the minute it got back to admin, they immediately took action because he wasn't tenured, and they fired him.
The very fact that they're firing people that are trying to educate people about this issue, combined with the fact that government is depending on this issue as a new money scheme, I mean, that alone should tell you that they really don't want people to be educated or to know about this issue. That, to me, indicates that there's a real huge problem here.
Well, there is. There's absolutely a huge problem. I mean, there's so much information that's available now that disproves all the initial claims that were made way back at the time the climate models were being invented. And I was at Oregon State University in their atmospheric science program when this idea of developing a climate model to predict the climate came about. And all of us back then even knew, we don't see how you're ever going to be able to do this and get around the mathematical constraints that would be in such a model. And they never answered that question. They went right ahead and developed one. And the whole ideology behind how they work is very flawed. It's a leap of faith to think you're going to get an accurate answer out of it. Because when you develop a climate model, you know, in order to make the calculations that run the model, you've got to divide the Earth up into rectangular grids. And the number of calculations you've got to make for a climate model, because of the time frame you're integrating out to, you know, you're not talking about days, you're talking about years, up to 100 years. You've got to make many, many more calculations each time you make a run of the whole planet. And in order to keep the calculations stabilized where they don't blow up on you, you have to make the grids larger. But if you're going to make the grids larger, you're going to lose track more of that energy than you would even in a short-term weather forecast model. And they try to get around this by saying, well, that may be true, but we're going to treat the whole problem like it's a boundary value problem in mathematics, where we let the system run randomly, and we know we're not going to get the weather right anywhere on the Earth after just a few days of running the model, but because the physics in the model are correct, somehow because the Earth is spherical, we think the radiative balance will all work itself out, and lo and behold, 100 years down the road, we'll be able to pull the temperature out of the rabbit hat. I mean, that's just complete nonsense.
It almost sounds like these climatologists, people that are making these predictions, they almost need the Earth to be flat.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, they use the spherical shape of it to get around trying to say that we can ignore some of these constraints that we know exist in the model. And you just can't do that. I mean, the biggest problem that they have is because they lose track of energy flow and transformation, they're certainly going to lose track of where cloud formation and destruction occurs. And that's where the large radiative transfers from the ground occur that try to get to outer space. Clouds intercept those. Evaporation from the surface by water vapor removes heat and then puts it under the troposphere where it's radiated as a cloud, as a black body. And because they can't predict those and where they're going to occur accurately, they're not going to have the balance of how much sunlight gets in accurately calculated. They're not going to have the amount of infrared radiation that's going out. They won't have any of those calculated correctly. So it's no surprise that errors will accumulate with time in such a model. And then by the time you're out to 100 years, you have a useless heap of junk that can't tell you much of anything, and the error bars are going to be much larger than what you're trying to predict. I mean, it's just, the whole thing is silly.
Well,
we're not at the point where we can do any of this right now. We just don't have the ability to do it.
A prediction that far out that it just junk, I mean, that's shocking that that's what we're basing trillions of dollars of spending on. All right, let's go and take a break. We'll continue our discussion about Oregon's latest scheme, the Climate Protection Plan. The comment period for that is open right now and ends August 30th. We'll have some links that you can use to access that and leave your comments for them on iSpyRadio.com. That's iSpyRadio.com, the letter I, iSpyRadio.com, and today's show page is 14-34. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Chuck Weiss. He's a meteorologist and fearsome global warming debunker. And right now we need that because Oregon is looking at pushing their climate protection plan, the CPP. This will add thousands of dollars to people's bills, I think, every year. When you look at it all across the spectrum, there are food increase prices, utility prices going up, on and on down the list. And Chuck, in that last segment, you had mentioned something that I thought rather interesting, but I had wanted to talk to you about it off air just a little bit, just to kind of get a sense of it. You had mentioned that when they're doing those climate change prediction models, they actually lose track of the energy faster than when they're doing a 2 or 3 day forecast. So why is that?
That's because in order to make the calculations, Mark, you have to divide the Earth up into a grid system of rectangles. You need that to do your calculations. And if you're going to make a lot of calculations, meaning a lot of time integration, you're trying to predict way out into the future, the number of iterations that's required to do that increases very fast, almost exponentially. And so if your grids are too small, you'll get so many calculations that have to be made, even with high-speed computers, the calculating will explode to a point where it's unsolvable. And they've got to stabilize that by making the grids bigger so that there's less iterations that have to be done in order to make the calculations. But if the grid size is bigger, that means you lose track of energy flow and transformation faster in a climate model than you do in a short-term weather forecast model. But they don't care because they say we don't have to get the weather correct in space and time coordinates in a climate model. Somehow they think because of the spherical geometry of the Earth that over a large period of time, the radiative balance will all work itself out, even though they don't get the weather forecast right in any particular point after a certain amount of time. It'll still all balance out, and they'll be able to pull a temperature out of the rabbit hat and tell you what the temperature of the Earth will look like 100 years from now, and even what weather patterns will look like. Well, I mean, that's just absolutely ridiculous. Well, there's no way you can do it.
Sure. And you know, it kind of comes back around to what I started the show with, which is that if you have bad data, that leads to bad information. When you get bad information, you lead to bad decisions. So if they have these effectively useless climate models, then why are we even bothering with this whole climate change protection plan?
Well, because they're going back to their assumption that the climate models are actually worth something and their forecasts are accurate. And the fact that they predicted warming and we have had some warming, is more of a coincidence than anything else, because at the time they invented the climate models, we had just finished the Great Pacific Climate Shift of 1977 to the warm phase of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And that ocean cycle flip causes warming. It causes more El Nino events than La Ninas, and it causes weather pattern changes that can lead to a global warming by getting, for example, a slight decrease in the Earth's albedo, and we've actually measured that. That is a close match to what the temperature increases have actually been. If you run the numbers on CO2, they're just measly, because the amount of radiation from CO2 that could cause any warming is just minuscule compared to the other players around it, whether it's solar energy or whether it's water vapor and clouds. I mean, we knew from atmospheric science years ago, Mark, that the hydrological cycle, which is a conversion of water vapor to clouds and precipitation that's occurring all around the Earth from our weather systems, we knew a long time ago that that's what keeps the Earth's optical depth stable. And it doesn't allow it to change much, even if CO2 is increasing and doing a little bit of an increase on its part. And when I talk about optical depth, I mean, just think of it this way. Optical depth can be thought of as the number of blankets you put over yourself at night to keep warm. CO2 is not a blanket, it's a sheet. It's not going to do much of anything. But water vapor and clouds are the blankets that actually regulate how comfortable you'll stay at night. And so if you put another sheet on top of CO2, you're not going to do very much to change anything if the blanket decreases at all, or you take the blanket or roll it off of you to compensate for the fact that you might feel a little bit too warm from CO2, the CO2 sheet. And that's how the atmosphere works. It's constantly compensating for what CO2 does, because water vapor, with its evaporative properties, its condensation properties, its, you know, it, all of the things thermodynamically that it does in the atmosphere are self-regulating. And you can't change that except if you add external energy, like we're seeing right now with this slight increase in the amount of solar energy that's reaching the surface. So external energy can change the climate. And so if the albedo changes, you'll get that. But the radiative changes, or the atmosphere's, you know, greenhouse gases cannot change it because of water vapor getting in the way. I mean, we knew these things years ago, and nothing's changed except for the inventing of these climate models, which don't work. They're overrated heaps of junk, and you can't get around the constraints that are in them. But yet, these people that are running them claim, yeah, they're the next best thing to Swiss cheese. We can rely on accurate predictions from them, and the truth of the matter is we can't. But that's what sets the public policy, and the public policy is just as disastrous because, like I said, we're not even responsible for the direction and magnitude that CO2 has gone in the atmosphere. Our contribution from burning fossil fuel is only a small fraction of what actually increased. So there's nothing that adds up in this whole program. I mean, it's an absolute fraud. It's not going to accomplish one single thing that the people implementing it want to do. And I think it's outrageous that Kate Brown, when the voters said, we don't want this sort of a climate program, it's almost like a carbon tax, we don't want it, we voted it down, and she shoved it down our throat anyway. And then the appeals court overturned the way they tried to do this, and now they're back at it again. And it's going to be even more expensive now than it would have been under the old rules, the way they're adopting them now, according to companies like Northwest Natural that are looking at it. So people need to get out there and write their public comments about this and say we're absolutely outraged at the fact that the state wants to do this to people again, basically fleecing your pocketbook, transferring wealth from your own pocketbook to these 501(c)(3)s, and these individuals are going to get this money and like install public charging stations and weatherization projects, planting trees. It's all a complete waste of time, and it isn't going to accomplish a thing. You're just going to have to pay for all the silliness. I mean, that's how bad this whole thing is.
Well, and I know that in our discussions that we had earlier in the week here before the show, one of the things that was really pretty troubling was there was no means to verify any of this, and that's a huge part of these carbon credit schemes. So we'll talk about that next with Chuck Weiss. Stay with us. And welcome back. And in our final segment now, we're talking about the climate protection plan that Oregon has schemed up, and scheme it is. We're talking about that with Chuck Weiss. He's a meteorologist and trained scientist and fearsome global warming debunker. And so, Chuck, I'd like to just touch on this whole carbon credit scheme, because this is really the backbone of all of this, is that it is a funding model to take money from people that are active producers and funnel it to these nonprofits and politically allied people. I think more than anything, that seems to be the real goal of all of this. Plus, there's the element that it's not going to reduce anything. In fact, there's a rather perverse incentive to keep polluting, because the people that are making the money off this pollution, the ones that are selling those credits, they effectively want people to keep polluting. Otherwise, they won't make any money if there's no one to sell those credits to. So there's really no incentive to stop the emissions. Like I said, the carbon credit scheme is really one of the big features of this climate protection plan. And you know, over the years, I've been resistant really to look into the carbon credit schemes to try to understand them with any real depth, because you're basically dealing with imaginary problems and solving it with imaginary solutions. And I generally have a hard time understanding things that run contrary to reality. But there are two broad types of carbon schemes. One is a cap and trade program, which is imposed by the government, setting maximum emissions on industries and then punishing the companies that exceed those. And then voluntary carbon credit schemes. Do you know which one of these this would fall under? Is it mandatory in terms of you can only emit so much, or is it a voluntary situation?
No, it's mandatory. Once they've identified you as a participant, as a supplier, such as a gas company, or you know whether they sell natural gas or gasoline or electricity. You know, PGE also is considered to be an emitter and part of the program. You're in the program, and so you're going to be subjected to having to pay that $129 per metric ton if you go over their allotted amount of emissions per year that they're going to assign you. And that's the number I was asking them for that I never got any answer back on, because you can't figure out what that's going to cost a company until they know the answer to that. And I didn't get any answers, no return calls. It's outrageous that our own government behaves this way and doesn't give people the answers to questions that they're asking. So it is mandatory. You don't have a choice. If you're identified as one of the people in the program by the total amount of metric tons of carbon that they claim you emit per year, you have no choice but to be in the program. It isn't voluntary at all. And so there are different things you can do if you volunteer to buy some of the credits. I think you can trade some of those. But I'm not sure how that trading program works. That's not really explained in great detail either. The bottom line is, though, for every metric ton of CO2 that these companies go over in supplying to end users like you and me, they've got to pay $129 per metric ton. And there's a lot of metric tons out there of CO2 because of the cumulative use of all these fuels by us as a population in the state of Oregon. And so there's all kinds of money that's going to be changing hands with this thing, and it's not for the better. It's just going to totally screw over everybody who has to buy natural gas or fill your car with gasoline. There's going to be an added tax, and it's actually just a fee. They'll call it a fee that the gas companies are going to tack on that covers their cost, that they have to pay this fee to the DEQ, which then goes to the 501Cs and all these community organizers that are supposedly going to use this to invest it in what they call the climate protection, protecting the climate. I mean, this is just ridiculous. I mean, is it going to protect anybody from anything?
Right.
It's just a complete ruse.
Yes.
But that's in a nutshell how a lot of this is going to work. But unfortunately, because Nicole Singh doesn't return phone calls and neither do her supervisors to give information out about exactly what this would cost, we don't have the answers. And they want the comment period apparently to expire before they tell us exactly what it's going to cost. That's outrageous too. That's why we should be getting answers to it now, and why they should be providing it to us, and they don't want to do it, or they didn't do it.
Right.
And they can say whatever they want, but is there any excuse when you have a valid question of not getting an answer before the comment period ends? And that's coming up next week.
Right, exactly. So just to nutshell this for people, in a cap and trade system, a government or regulatory body sets up a cap on the total amount of greenhouse gases that can be emitted. Companies are issued a certain number of carbon credits and can trade them in a market. If a company emits less than its allotted amount, it can sell those excess credits to other companies that are exceeding their limits. If someone exceeds, they have to buy these credits to offset whatever carbon it is that they have exceeded by. A large part of the problem with this is the verification process, because carbon credits, so that's one of the big concerns and criticisms about them, is because there's no real means to verify that the projects that these credits are going to pay for, you know, what kind of effect they're actually having. In fact, it's really open for a lot of scams. Some of these, South Pole, which is one of these, they were simply pocketing the cash while claiming to fight global warming. They're not. Some of these companies are paid to plant trees. They're not actually out there planting them. It really reminds me, the whole carbon cap and trade scheme, it really reminds me of the medieval Catholic Church's system of selling indulgences, where you could essentially buy your way to forgiveness of sins without actually stopping the sinning.
That's exactly what the whole program does. There's no way. I mean, I'd like to ask them these questions when this money goes to the 501Cs. Let's say they're going to put in some weather stripping, or they're going to install a rapid charge station somewhere that's approved by the DEQ. Blah 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 blah. So they say, okay, this will reduce our emissions. They'll come up with some sort of an estimate. And my question to them would be, okay, so you're claiming that we're damaging the climate. They've said this over and over. The media regurgitates this nonsense. This summer about the heat has just been unbelievably bad, how much propaganda and nonsense has been out over the airwaves about the heat waves,
sure,
and they're being caused by humans. So my question to them is, okay, for all the money that it's going to cost the public in paying extra money for their gas bills, to whether it's natural gas or gasoline, to fund this whole program, for the money that they spent on this, can you tell me how many Columbus Day storms will we get in the future? Can you tell me that? How many thunderstorms are we going to get? Tornadoes? How about those? Snowstorms?
The last week or so, it's been cooling a little bit, so maybe they'll just preemptively take credit for that. That, gosh, look at that. Our plans are already working, and we haven't even started it yet.
The problem is,
Chuck, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. We're going to have to talk to you about this in more depth next time.
Okay, it's good enough, Mark. Hope everybody gets their comments in.
So after our interview, Chuck finally got through on the phone to Nicole Singh, who could not answer his questions, but promised to send him links about their calculations. Last I heard from him, she still had not sent them. He also asked, even if Oregon eliminated all of its emissions, since they are such a minuscule part of global emissions, what do they hope to accomplish when China is making up for any of our reductions and increasing its emissions? He said he got about 15 seconds of silence, followed by, I know you may not agree with this program, but there are many who do. And regardless of what everyone else is doing, Oregon needs to reduce its share of global emissions. Well, that's fine. Then maybe they should just apply the carbon credit scheme to those true believers who agree, and they can pay more for everything. Otherwise, it's a bit like forcing people to tithe who don't even belong to your church. And here's big news. While verifying the website, I double-checked the comment period, and lo and behold, they have suddenly extended it due to a statutory requirement to extend because an interested person needed more time to submit data or arguments concerning the CPP. That deadline is now September 27th. See today's show page 14-34 on iSpyRadio.com for the link to submit your comments. Don't wait, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.